Web streaming of 90.3 WPLN-FM is made possible by listener support and by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, the promise of discovery. Learn how you can support this service at NashvillePublicRadio.org.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle.
And I'm Peter Sagal. It was more than 100 years ago that Finley Peter Dunn said, "Politics ain't beanbag," which means that for more than 100 years, people have been asking, "What the hell is beanbag?" On this week's show, it's all politics all the time. Plus, Sir Peter Westmacott, the British ambassador to the U.S., joins us to tell us how it's done in the old country. Short version, it's just as dumb, but sometimes they wear wigs. Plus, Carl Castle shows his skills at diplomacy.
Can't we all just get along?
We will, we promise, on our quiz that's coming up right after this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Obama is urging Congress to reach a deal that would prevent tax hikes and spending cuts from taking effect in the new year. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports the president is accusing Republicans of standing in the way of compromise.
At this point, there's still a real chance that Congress will pass the Monday night deadline without an agreement. President Obama says if that happens, it will be Republicans' fault. He spoke on NBC's Meet the Press.
So far, at least, Congress has not been able to get this stuff done, not because Democrats in Congress don't want to go ahead and cooperate, but because I think it's been very hard for Speaker Boehner and Republican Leader McConnell to accept the fact that taxes on the wealthiest Americans should go up a little bit in as part of an overall deficit reduction package.
The president rejected the idea that he shares any blame for this impasse. He said the offers he's made, quote, have been so fair that a lot of Democrats get mad at me. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
On another television talk show this morning, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says the chances are exceedingly good there can be agreement on a small proposal to avoid the fiscal cliff. But he fears a modified plan won't address the deep cuts in defense spending scheduled to take effect on the 1st. Graham told Fox News Sunday Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is worried as well.
He says if we do this, it will be shooting the Defense Department in the head, and we'll have to send out 800,000 layoff notices the beginning of the year. He's worried to death that if we don't fix sequestration, we're going to destroy the finest military in the world at the time we need it the most.
Both the Senate and the House will be in session this afternoon. Most of the major provisions of the Obama administration's health care legislation don't start until the year 2014. But NPR's Julie Rovner reports 2013 will bring some noticeable changes.
Most of the 2013 changes are in anticipation of more major policies that take effect in 2014, things like bans on exclusions for pre-existing conditions, expansions to the Medicaid program for the poor, and new insurance marketplaces called exchanges, where individuals and small businesses will be able to shop for coverage. For example, starting January 1st, state Medicaid programs will have to pay the higher Medicare rates to doctors who provide primary care. That's an effort to encourage more doctors to serve Medicaid patients. And open enrollment in the exchanges begins October 1st, 2013, for coverage that actually starts next January 1st. That's when most Americans will be required to either have health insurance or pay a tax penalty. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
New England residents are digging out from another snowstorm. As much as a foot of snow fell by the time the storm ended this morning. This followed a major storm last week, which also hit the Midwest and the southern U.S. This is NPR News from Washington. The international envoy to Syria says as many as 100,000 people could die in Syria next year if there is no negotiated end to the civil war. Lakhdar Brahimi told reporters in Cairo, "The situation is very, very bad and getting worse." He said a political solution is still possible, but much must be done.
There are a lot of devils in the details. Let us start identifying those devils and dealing with them one after the other.
Brahimi warns Syria could become another Somalia, which hasn't had a functional central government since 1991 and is run by various warlords. Activists say at least 40,000 people have been killed in Syria since the uprising against President Bashar al-Assad began 21 months ago. Students, parents, and faculty from Sandy Hook Elementary School are on hand for the New York Giants football game today. The team invited the guests to play a role in a pregame ceremony which begins shortly. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Hundreds of guests from Newtown, Connecticut will attend the Giants' final regular season game. Members of the Sandy Hook community will circle the field during the national anthem, and they'll share in a moment of silence before the game to honor the victims of the shooting spree earlier this month that killed 26 people, including 20 children. Giants wide receiver Victor Cruz has already met the family of one victim. After the shootings, Cruz visited with the family of 6-year-old Jack Pinto after learning that the young shooting victim was a Giants fan. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
A New York judge is ordering a woman undergo a psychiatric evaluation. She's been charged with murder as a hate crime. Investigators say she told them she pushed a man in front of a subway last week because she thought he was a Muslim. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Republic Records, with selections from the Les Miserables soundtrack, including I Dreamed a Dream and Suddenly. Available now.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Colonel Castle, and here's your host, coming to you from the Music Center at Strathmore in North Bethesda, Maryland, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. We share your excitement. We do. We have a fabulous show for you today. We're particularly excited to have the British ambassador to the United States, Sir Peter Westmacott, joining us to talk about international relations. In fact, our show this week is all about politics, past and present, domestic and foreign. And of course, the key to politics is spin, the art of turning something bad into something good. For example, I might say, we are totally burned out, so we're taking a break from the week's news. But Spinmeister Carl will say,
this allows us to bring you the most fascinating hour in broadcast history.
There, you feel better. So give us a call. The number, as always, 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
John McBride, Dallas, Texas.
Well, hello, John. How are you?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm pretty well. How are things in Dallas?
Very good.
And what do you do there?
Chief Financial Officer at the Nasher Sculpture Center.
What is that?
It's a small museum. We have Ernesto Neto on display.
Yeah.
We've got a Picasso out front. We've got some de Koonings, Giacometti's.
I thought it would be mostly big bronze cattle. That's what I've seen.
No, that's down the street.
Okay, all right. Let me introduce you, John, to our panel this week. First, say hello to the man behind Esquire's politics blog and a contributor to Grantland.com, Mr. Charlie Pierce is here.
Hey, John.
Next, a comedian whose Comedy Central special is available on iTunes, Ms. Jessie Klein.
Hi, John.
And finally, an author and humorist whose blog now appears at cartalk.com with embarrassing regularity, Mr. Tom Baudette.
Hello, John.
So, John, we're in Bethesda. We're near Washington. We know there's no hope for the U.S. government. We can smell the failure from here. But we want to try and still fix the system. So we looked around the globe for inspiration from other countries. And Carl has collected all this wisdom and put together his very own guide to good government.
And I call it the Magna Carl.
So your job today is to explain what he is talking about. Interpret his lesson. Two times out of three, do that, you'll win our prize. Ready to play?
Excellent, yeah.
All right. Our first piece of advice comes from Taiwan.
You catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, but you catch the most flies of all by punching them.
What could we learn from the Taiwanese strategy that to settle legislative differences, sometimes you have to do what?
Punch them in the face.
Yes, indeed. I rise to make a motion of my fist toward your nose. In 2007, the Speaker of the Taiwanese Parliament wanted to bring up a bill. The opposition party preferred that he not do that. So he invoked a little-known provision of Robert's Rules of Kicking Ass. A huge fistfight ensued on the floor of Parliament. It was videotaped, and it went on with fists flying and all kinds of things until a group of visiting third graders ran in to restore order. Now, much was made of this when this happened, but can you imagine how much fun it would be if we imported this tradition to our government?
Tonight, it's the Capitol Smackdown. Nancy, not-so-Nancy Pelosi, makes John beat-down Boehner cry for a reason.
If they would do that, C-SPAN's ratings would be through the roof.
Exactly! Imagine
you,
how...
You would have pay-per-view on C-SPAN. It would be great.
Well, and over time, it would attract a different kind of politician. Eventually, we'd have, like, these cage fighter guys in Congress.
Yes. Because
people would want their rep to be the baddest...
Governor Jesse Ventura, the comeback.
There you go.
But really, it would be great. Imagine if, like, the Speaker of the House on C-SPAN, right? The Speaker of the House takes out his gavel, and the minority leader responds by breaking out his nunchucks. And what if the majority whip had one?
I just think it would be a nice change if the biggest problem in Congress was steroids.
You know?
Well, there would be turnover, obviously. And as these more capable fighters, like professional wrestlers and cage match fighters, started to integrate into Congress, the actual overall intellectual capacity of the body would improve.
You'd think. And,
it could be a good thing.
You'd have Ruth Bader Ginsburg walking around holding up a round number. Wearing presumably a severe gray flannel bikini, I guess, would be appropriate.
Oh.
I guess they don't care for that fabric. I don't know. All right, less fighting over principles, more actual fighting. That's lesson one. Let's hear Carl's next piece of advice. This one we learned from Great Britain.
Every piece of legislation looks great after the fifth beer.
That comes from the British Parliament. Our Congress here could learn a thing or two from that body's long-standing tradition of doing what?
Drinking while legislating?
Exactly right. The British Parliament does not want their members to drive drunk by going out to bars, but they don't mind if they legislate drunk. So the British Parliament actually has up to 4 bars operating in the Parliament building itself, open to members. This has, woohoo! This has led to some colorful episodes, as when one lawmaker named Mark Reckless, really, says he doesn't remember whether he even voted for one bill. And there was a time one lawmaker got drunk and headbutted 2 of his rivals in the bar. You know, things had finally gotten out of hand when one member filed a motion to change the name of the British Parliament to the British Parliament Funkadelic.
Do they have 4 bars?
Do they have 4 bars?
They have like a food court in a banana republic too.
Again, it's another good idea. It would be. If I was a legislator, I'd want to have that kind of cover, you know. This is like,
oh, yeah.
You know, you go back to the home base and they say, why'd you vote for... I had a few too many.
Well, I mean, you'd get stuff accomplished, though, right? I mean, you know, people would wake up, legislators would wake up the next morning next to enormous spending bills they didn't recognize. They'd be like, oh, God, last night your earmarks seemed so cute.
See, I think that it's actually a really good idea because then everybody would be... If you're drunk, you're a lot more honest, you know, so you'd have congressmen just being like, I'm against gay marriage, all right, because I'm gay and I hate myself. You know, you'd save a lot of time.
I know, yeah.
Because that process usually takes years. Just admit it right then.
All right. So a little liquor might smooth out things. We learned that from Britain. Here's your last bit of advice.
If you can't say anything nice... You'll be fined if you say anything at all.
Carl is referring to the case of Michael O'Brien. He was the gaming minister for the Australian state of Victoria. He was getting a lot of public criticism in 2011, so he put forward a law and passed it that made what illegal?
Being rude.
Being rude to whom?
A state official.
Specifically, to him is the answer. The gaming minister made it illegal to insult the gaming minister, claiming the insults made it hard to do his job properly. He tacked on an amendment to the Gaming Regulation Act. It fined violators $12,000 for insulting or mocking the person in charge of the Gaming Regulation Act. That would be him. It's called the I'm Rubber, You're Glue Act. It was actually passed. It is law in the state of Victoria, but Mr. O'Brien forgot to include a ban on sarcasm. So now everybody there is like, oh yeah, he's the greatest minister ever.
I'm on our local select board in Vermont, and I'm just thinking, I wonder if a town ordinance could work.
Really? You can't? People say mean things about you as a selectman?
Oh, constantly, yes. Yeah.
Give us a sample.
I can't.
I can't. If they illegalized political insults here in America, would cripple our economy. I mean, Fox News and MSNBC would have to change their business
model. I'd be out of a gig for sure.
It's Bill O'Reilly's hour of silence. Carl, how did John do in our quiz?
Very well, Peter. 3 correct answers. So, John, I'll be doing the message on your voicemail or home answering machine.
Well done. Congratulations, John.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
We want to remind everybody to join us most weeks back home at the Chase Bank Auditorium. For tickets and more information, go to WBEZ.org, or you can find a link at our website, waitwait.npr.org. Right now, panel, your turn. All your questions, of course, as they will be this show, are about politics. Tom, back in 1999, during a tense debate, the lieutenant governor of Alabama was forced to do what on the State House floor?
In a tense debate, the governor...
Yeah, very tense. A lot at stake.
Breathe into a brown paper bag.
No. Well, when I say he did it on the floor, I mean he did it on the floor.
Oh, my goodness. He wet himself.
No, close enough. He urinated. He urinated on the House floor. This is what happened back in 1999.
Without getting any on himself?
Yeah. It was it was intentional.
He was making a point.
No, he wasn't making... Everybody's a critic. No, what happened was... There was this huge legislative fight in Alabama, and he had the floor of the House during this fight, and he knew if he left the floor, his political opponents would grab control of the session.
Oh.
And nature called, and called again, and so he decided to finally take the call behind the speaker's podium.
Turns out
he hadn't been state house trained.
Since then, they've installed a urinal back.
No, well, what happened was, actually, is the sergeant of arms came in and rubbed his nose in it and said, bad, bad, Lieutenant Governor. Coming up, our panelists mend some fences in a political rivalries bluff the listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play. And we test the limits of the special relationship as British Ambassador Sir Peter Westmacott joins us to play Not My Job. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Focus Features with the new film Promised Land, starring Matt Damon and John Krasinski, from the director of Good Will Hunting, in theaters everywhere on Friday. Comité Champagne, with a reminder that sparkling wines come from all over the world. Champagne comes from Champagne, France, at champagne.us. And eSurance, an Allstate company, offering Coverage Counselor, an online tool that provides car insurance options based on users' needs, at eSurance.com. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. We're playing this week with Jesse Klein, Tom Baudette, and Charlie Pierce. And here again is your host at the Music Center at Strathmore in North Bethesda, Maryland, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, guys. Right now, it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game in the air. How are you, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Hey, this is Landon calling from New Orleans, Louisiana.
New Orleans? How are things in New Orleans? One of my favorite cities there is.
It is hot.
What do you do there?
I ride in a carnival parade.
You do? You ride in a Mardi Gras float?
I do, yeah. Crew of Tote.
Crew of what?
The crew of Tote.
Of Tote.
Tote.
Toad?
Toth.
T-H-O-T-H.
Oh, Toth.
Toth, yeah. It's an Egyptian god, half ibis, half man.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And what?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. God, sorry.
Crew of Toad is the NPR float every year.
Well, welcome to the show, Landon.
Thanks.
You're going to play our game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Landon's topic?
Can't we all just get along?
Political rivalries are as old as time, of course, but this week our panelists are going to tell you about two political nemeses bridging the divide and coming together in an unexpected way. Guess the true story, you'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine or voicemail. You ready to play?
Estoy listo.
He's bilingual.
That's right.
All right. Let us hear first from Mr. Charlie Pierce.
In the East Hedgepath by-election in Surrey, Labour candidate Martin Smith Pigott and Tory standard-bearer Walter Godolphin have both been enthusiastically touting their up-from-the-bootstraps biographies. Both men were orphans, and the campaign had been an exercise in who could out-orphan the other. Godolphin, for example, had a television ad in which he touted his superiority in that he had been adopted after Smith Pigott and therefore had been an orphan longer. "We'll have no adoptees come lately," he thundered. That all came to an end last week when the local newspaper hired a genealogist to trace the ancestry of local celebrities. Naturally, both candidates eagerly signed up, and it was revealed that they actually were twin sons separated at birth from their teenage mother and sent to different foster families in the area. The two men then made a joint appearance with their biological mother and their stepmoms and stepdads and promised all the moms that they would behave henceforth, quote, like brothers should. "Oh, Lord," said their mother, "not that."
Two rivals discovering they're actually brothers separated at birth. Your next story of rivals teaming up unexpectedly comes from Jesse Klein.
Until recently, Republican John Perzel and Democrat Bill DeWeese were rivals, both former speakers of the Pennsylvania State House and sworn partisan enemies who stood on the opposite side of most issues. However, their antagonism fell by the wayside when they became close friends in, you guessed it, jail. Both men found themselves incarcerated at a Camp Hill state prison after being convicted of separate, unrelated corruption charges. The two decided to bunk together and pretty soon became BFFs. It's like one long sleepover party for the new besties, who've reportedly been bonding over everything from inedible lunch meat to ill-fitting jumpsuits. Some sources say they've even been seen spotting each other in the exercise yard. Sure, they're only lifting 5-pound weights, but they're just new. They'll improve. They're like a real-life odd couple, except in this case they're not bachelors, just thieves who stole from the people who elected them.
Two bitter rivals become friends in jail after both being arrested for corruption. Your last story of reaching across the aisle comes from Tom Baudette.
Boston City Councilmember Rafe Segalen had had enough of the Environmental Committee Chair and Boaz standing in the way of his grand designs. When Councilmember Boaz recently quashed his plan for a Big Dig shopping plaza, Segalen lost it. He sent her a shoebox of poop gathered from his yard and his helpful Bernese mountain dog, Paco. When Boaz opened the package, she lost it too and got mad. Mad enough to turn the box over to the Boston Police Crime Lab for analysis. Results, 1, it was dog poop. 2, probably from a Bernese mountain dog. 3, the dog had a rare and severe form of canine anemia. Anemia, thought Boaz, the very disease her beloved Berner Paco died of 5 years earlier. If only we'd caught it sooner. It didn't take long scouring the Facebook pages of her political adversaries to find a picture of the smiling Councilman Segalen with his arms around the neck of a gorgeous burner named, oh my God, Paco. Boaz called Segalin to give him hell, but she couldn't stay mad and found herself blurting out the news about the anemia and imploring Segalin to drop everything and get Paco to a vet. Now, 6 months later, you see a Suburban and a Prius parked side by side in the City Hall parking lot with matching burner on board stickers in the back windows. Boaz and Segalin have teamed up and are the unstoppable force behind the new $60 million Boston Common Dog Park and free animal health clinic breaking ground next spring.
Two rivals bond over their Burmese mountain dogs in a helpful discovery. So, let us review your choices.
Okay.
From Charlie Pierce, two rivals finding out they're actually twins separated at birth. Jesse Klein, two bitter political enemies bonding while in prison on separate corruption charges. Or from Tom Baudet, how a message of dog poop became a symbol of friendship. Which of these is the real story of political rivals coming together?
Yeah, I'm a twin, so I would like for the first one to be the real one, but I think I've actually read about this, and I'm going to go with Jesse's story.
You're going to go with Jesse's story of the two Pennsylvania politicians who bonded in prison. All right. Well, we spoke to someone familiar with the real story.
The processing prison in Pennsylvania not only has two former House speakers in the prison, but they are cellmates.
There you are. That was Pete DeCourcy. He's the bureau chief of Capital Wire telling us about the Pennsylvania politicians. Congratulations, you got it right. Jesse was telling the truth. You have won our prize. Excellent. Carl's voice in your voicemail. Congratulations. Well done. Thank you so much for playing.
Oh, thank you, too.
You got trouble, and I got them, too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, see it through, because you've got a friend.
And now the game where we invite distinguished people on to do something undistinguished. Now, we do what damage we can on this show, but it's not often we get the chance to cause a real international incident. So we're very excited about our guest today, Sir Peter Westmacott, who's Great Britain's ambassador to the United States of America. Sir Peter, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Pleasure to
have you. Thank you very much.
So I think, if I'm not mistaken, you're our first knight. But so should we address you as Sir Peter Westmacott, your liege? What's the? We don't know.
I think you can settle for Peter.
Peter is fine.
That's all right.
Now, I think I'm going to call you Sir Peter, because how
Sir
often
Peter.
Will I get this chance? I mean, I do it in a mirror, but this is for real. So
how is it?
It's fun. I enjoy it.
Do I get a chance to defend the honor of my members of Parliament who you've accused of being drunk?
You may. I mean, you do have bars in Parliament. That's sort of...
This is true.
Yes. Mm. And do you think those help?
They probably oil the wheels of government.
A little bit. They lubricate.
I would not want you to think that, as a general rule, laws are passed while honourable members are under the influence of alcohol.
Right.
Except perhaps when they passed that idiotic law that allowed a bunch of cowboys to tow my car wherever they found it parked, regardless of whether it was parked illegally or not.
Really?
That was a bad law.
Now, you have an extensive resume in the British Foreign Service. You've been all over, right?
Well, I've been in a lot of different countries, and I've been in this business for almost 40 years.
Right. And I'm curious, I mean, does the Queen ever summon you with a message to send?
Not that often, but...
No.
But occasionally, she will send me a little email saying, here's a nice letter I'd like you to send to that nice President Barack Obama in the White House. Please send it around.
Really? You get little... Did you say emails? Does the Queen email?
Oh, she's very modern. She does Twitter, she does email, she does Facebook, she does all sorts.
Wait a minute.
What? The Queen
you're,
is on
you're
Twitter?
You're not following the Queen?
The Queen of England tweets?
You check it out.
So you were the ambassador to France prior to this?
I was ambassador to France prior to this. Before that, I was ambassador to Turkey. And I've also served in Iran before the revolution.
Right. I mean, it seems odd to us that they would award plum ambassadorships on merit.
To somebody like me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Presumably. I mean, presumably because of your ability or something, rather than...
Well, I did years of language training before I came here.
Really?
So that was
it's,
a
it's really excellent. Your accent is a little off, but
yeah.
Otherwise you
well,
sound fluent. I know, I appreciate
it. I have an American wife, born and brought up in Bethesda, Maryland, I might add. But so.
Oh, really? do you acquire one of those for every country you visit?
I don't change them that often.
I understand.
So talk to us. We're talking about politics this week. I want to hear your observations, diplomatic as I'm sure they will be, about the differences between the British and the American system. Because you're over here and you see how we do things. And I'm wondering, in general, what your reaction is to the American political culture and ways and means.
Wow, this is getting serious.
Yes.
Well, I have been here before, so yes. I had a little bit of a look at what how bipartisan life was in the middle of the 1990s when you were busy impeaching your president. So
yes.
You know, that's obviously... some things haven't changed a huge amount.
No.
As for the differences, well, of course, you did set up a political system all those years ago, which I think was probably designed to ensure that something that you rather unkindly called tyranny could not be imported across the ocean to the United States of America.
Yeah.
So you set up a system designed kind of not to work, as I understand it.
That's pretty much the idea.
So that's one of the differences.
Yeah. We did find out, for all your skill as a diplomat, we did find out that there was an incident in your past that you caused a bit of a scandal, as say, in France.
Which one?
Well, no. Tell you what, you go through them, I'll tell you the one I was thinking of. I didn't realize there was more than one.
You go first, Peter.
All right. We heard that there was a scandal when you served and you had the audacity to serve British cheese at a function in France.
Oh, that one.
That one.
Oh, that's okay.
That's okay? Oh, gosh, what did you think I was thinking of? Please tell me.
Well, I did serve British cheese because, for some reason I've never quite understood, a lot of my French friends believe that that is the one country in the world that makes good cheese. And as it happens, the reality is that in the United Kingdom we have lots and lots of wonderful cheeses too. So I used to have a bit of fun by showing my French friends that there are great British cheeses. I did not often expose them to great British red wine.
No.
But great British cheeses was fine.
You are a diplomat. You are an extremely experienced diplomat. Obviously, you're good at it. You wouldn't be here. We wanted to...
I mean, not
see,
here.
Not here.
Like in the United States. Right.
Yeah. We wanted to see
how...
Yeah,
I must have done something wrong to get here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yes. We wanted to see how your skills would work in everyday life. Hmm. So I want to present some situations to you and see how a professional, world-class diplomat would respond. So here we go. Does this dress make me look fat?
I think you look just marvelous in that dress.
That's very good.
Really. I particularly like the color.
Excellent.
I cannot imagine why you should think it makes you look anything other than perfect. Carefully, don't use the word fat again.
And you carefully have not answered the question.
That was very good.
Occasionally we don't.
All right, here we have another one. Ready? Would you mind reading a draft of my first novel?
I want to hear this.
I should be absolutely delighted. It's a real privilege to be asked to look at your first draft of the novel. But you don't expect me to write any comments on it, do you?
Right. Okay. But let's say you've read the first draft of the novel. Let's say it's awful.
Yeah.
And then I say, what did you think? Tell me the truth.
I particularly like the chapter where they talked about... the fun and games behind the bicycle shed on that island in the exotic Caribbean.
But what about the part where, like, the guys hold up the gas station and then they all sort of end up there together until the aliens come? Did you like that part?
Do you know, that chapter appealed to me a little bit less than the one I just mentioned.
Really? God, I really appreciate you being so frank with me.
I hope you will ask me next time you write a novel.
Oh, I absolutely will.
I'm sure that your publisher will come back to you very soon with a further suggestion that you follow up the stunning success of the first one with another contribution.
Sir Peter, I've written some poetry. I'd like you to look at it. That was excellent. Diplomatic work.
Peter, I want you to know we are sometimes sincere.
I appreciate that. Well, Ambassador, we are delighted that you are here, and we have invited you to play a game we're calling...
No homework, extended naps, and 8 hours of recess.
A lot of big-time politicians got their start as little-time politicians, running for the student councils in their schools. So we're going to ask you three questions about strange doings in the school halls of power. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in their home voicemail. Carl, who is Ambassador Sir Peter Westmacott playing for?
The ambassador is playing for Harry Clayman of Bethesda, Maryland.
All right. Local. Here we go. First question. Sometimes the future of a politician can be seen in their student days, such as in which of these people? A, Bill Clinton, who became president of Little Rock West Middle School, despite what was known then as the playing doctor incident. B, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who vanished from student council his senior year for a week, said he was just hiking the trails behind the school. Or C, famously corrupt lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who was disqualified from an eighth grade race for student council for trying to buy votes.
I think I have to plumb for C.
You can go for C, Jack Abramoff. You are correct. That's exactly right. Abramoff was disqualified from the race when he spent more than $100 buying hot dogs for student voters. All right, next question. A student named Haley Wade at the University of Calgary in Canada won election as student council vice president there, and most people say it was because she did what? A, promised to build a pipeline to campus from a nearby Molson Brewery. B, put up posters above the urinals and campus men's rooms that praised users on their endowment, shall we say. Or C, she brought a t-shirt gun to all her debates.
That's a tough one.
It is.
I'll try A.
You're going to go for A? She promised to build a beer pipeline to campus?
Some people do anything to get elected.
That's true.
But it's wrong.
It's wrong, sadly. She put up posters above men's room urinals praising the users on the size of their manhood. Haley said of the posters, quote, "Part of my platform is all about student engagement on the campus and effective communication with students," unquote. A male voter said, quote, "I ended up laughing out loud, creeping out to the person beside me, and peeing on my shoe," unquote. So this is very exciting. Last question. If you get this right, you win. Sometimes going the extra distance does not help. A New Jersey sixth grader named Zach Martini lost his race for student council president despite what? A, arranging a visit to the school from Justin Bieber. B, getting campaign advice from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Or C, putting up posters in the boys' room urinals praising the users in Dallas.
My guess is it probably isn't C.
Probably not.
I'll try Chris Christie.
You're right. That's what he did. He asked Mr. Christie for advice during a public Q&A. Christie told the young man to A, get colorful posters, B, ask for people's votes, and C, constantly berate public employees. Sadly, it didn't work in the case of young Mr. Martini. Carl, how did the ambassador do?
The ambassador had two correct answers, Peter, and that's enough to win for Harry Clayman.
Congratulations.
Wow. Thank you.
Sir Peter Westmacott is the British ambassador to the United States. Sir Peter, thank you so much for being with us here on Radio. An absolute delight.
I'm the ambassador of love and happiness.
In just a minute, Carl shows us his baby face in the Listener Limerick Challenge. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to join us on the air. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the International Rescue Committee, working to help people threatened and uprooted by war, disaster, and persecution. It's not charity, it's humanity. More at rescue.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, and Pimsleur Language Programs, offering tools to say happy holidays in more than 50 languages with 30-minute daily lessons at Pimsleur.com. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
And WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. We're playing this week with Tom Baudet, Jesse Klein, and Charlie Pierce. And here again is your host at the Music Center at Strathmore in North Bethesda, Maryland, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. In just a minute, Carl ratifies his very own bill of rhymes in our listener limerick challenge. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Panelists, it's time for a new game. We're calling it
Tippecanoe and Carl Too.
You can't run for office without a great slogan. Just ask President Jomentum Lieberman. Carl is going to read you some lesser-known political slogans. Pick the real one, you get a point. Jesse, you're up first. Filipino politician Junjun Soto ran for office with a particular slogan. Was it?
Junjun Soto. Two Junes, just that one prostitute.
Or?
Junjun Soto. I'll do my best, but I can't promise anything.
Or?
Junjun Soto. They named him twice. Vote for him twice.
I mean, anything less than all of them being real is unsatisfying. The second one?
Second one was, I'll do my best, but I can't promise anything?
That feels, where is this person from again?
The Philippines.
Oh, yeah, that's very typical of the Philippines, the kind of monster. I have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm going to just, yeah, randomly guess that one.
That's the one. Very good. Okay, Charlie. Oh. This one's for you. In 2009, Josko Risa was elected mayor of a town in Croatia based on a surprising political slogan. Was it?
Josko Risa. Hey, it's only Croatia.
Or?
Josko Risa. He'll occasionally show up for work.
Or?
Josko Risa. All for me, nothing for you.
Which one was it?
Well, since I know nothing of Croatian politics, I'm going to use the one that would make me vote for Mr. Risa, which is B.
He'll occasionally show up for
yes.
work?
Yes. If he promises to occasionally show up for work, I'll vote for him.
Sadly, it was all for me, nothing for you.
Oh!
He's elected. Says, Risa, I just told him the truth. He won in a landslide. All right, Tom, your turn. Jim Oberweis ran for governor of Illinois in 2006, and he borrowed from a classic advertising tagline for his slogan. How appropriate for you, sir. Was it?
Jim Oberweis, just do him.
Or?
Jim Oberweis, got gov?
Or?
Jim Oberweis is gubernatorial.
What was that first one again?
Jim Oberweis, just do him.
Oh, gosh. I so want that to be the one, but I have some trace memory of the gov thing actually happening. I'm gonna say that. Am I hallucinating?
No, you were right. That's
yeah,
it. Jim Oberweis got his money from running a family dairy company, .milk.gov. And, of course, the people of Illinois thought that was ridiculous and stupid, and, of course, in their wisdom, elected Rob Blagojevich instead. All right, panel, some questions for you about politics. Charlie, we want our politicians to be heroes. Newark Mayor Cory Booker rushed into a burning building to save the residents. And during the 2012 campaign, we learned Mitt Romney once helped stop a man from doing what?
Well, I know he stopped several people from enjoying themselves. This isn't the guy he had stop smoking dope on the beach
yes,
outside
it
his house.
Yes, it is, yeah. Charlie. Very good.
Yeah. As I said, stop people from enjoying themselves.
I know. According to a New York Times profile, once while at his beach home in La Jolla, California, Romney personally intervened to lecture a guy smoking a joint on the beach, and he also let his neighbors know he's not down with 420 in the hood. To put it in a way Mr. Romney never, ever would. Imagine, if you will, that poor pot smoker, wherever he is, people think he's always paranoid. He's like, no, really, the Republican presidential candidate might come in here and bust us any minute. It's happened before. The real question is, why would you choose a spot near Mitt Romney's house to smoke weed?
They're maybe just hoping that would happen.
It's like, oh, wow, dude, their car's on elevators. Watch them. Tom, a few years ago, the military wanted to significantly increase its presence on the island of Guam, but Democratic Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia feared it would have grave consequences for the island. Sending a lot of troops there, he feared, would do what?
I actually know the answer to this. He thought it would tip the island over.
Yes, he did. He thought it'd make one tip over. Speaking at a House Armed Services Committee meeting in 2010, Representative Johnson said, quote, "My fear is that the whole island will become so overly populated it will tip over and capsize." Mm-hmm. And the Navy Admiral in charge of the planned buildup said after a long pause, quote, "We don't anticipate that." It was amazing to find out that a member of Congress studies geopolitical strategy in his bathtub. Oh no, fortifying rubber ducky has caused it to turn over to the rescue, USS Squeaky Penguin. Ooh. If you don't know Democratic Representative Hank Johnson, he's the one you constantly see wearing water wings around the Capitol. Just in case.
See, this is why I was saying that having cage match fighters in Congress would not be an altogether bad thing.
You really can't make it any worse. Charlie, in the spring of 2012, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was forced to issue an official denial after being accused in the press of doing what at a Bruce Springsteen concert?
Falling asleep.
Yes, indeed. The one thing that a New Jersey governor can't do is to disrespect the boss. Seriously, you can do anything else in New Jersey. It's fine. No one cares. But anyway, the New York Post photographed him leaning back at the concert with his eyes closed. Christie says he was just feeling the music. No, he's been a fan. He said he's been a fan for a long time. Remember that video for Dancing in the Dark where Bruce and the entire E Street band strains to pull up a young Chris Christie to dance on stage?
He definitely could not go to Guam.
No. Coming up, it's Lightning Fill in the Blank. But first, it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Or you can click the Contact Us link on our website, waitwait.npr.org. There you can find out about attending our weekly live shows back at the Chase Bank Auditorium in Chicago, where you can pick up some Wait Wait tchotchkes. Hi, you're on Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Melissa McQueen from Denver, Colorado.
Hey, how are things in beautiful Denver?
They're just wonderful.
And what do you do there?
I teach fifth grade.
Do you really?
Yes.
And what do you teach those little guys?
I teach them all sorts of stuff. I teach every subject.
Really? So. What's your favorite unit to teach? What's your favorite subject?
Oh, it's got to be ancient Egypt.
Really?
Yes.
Have you ever heard of a god named Toth? And is that how you pronounce it?
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, I knew that guy was making it up. Welcome to the show, Melissa. Carl Castle is going to read you three limericks this week, all associated with politics. The last word or phrase will be missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly in two of the limericks, you'll be a winner. Here is your first limerick.
Though we might be infected with rabies, we'll change no votes to yeses or maybes. Their hearts we will hook with infantile looks. We earn trust when we look like
babies.
Yes, babies. According to a recent study by researchers in Jerusalem, voters prefer politicians who look like babies. This is because, said the lead researcher at Hebrew University, quote, people generally associate a baby face with attributes of honesty, openness, and acceptance, unquote. Also, babies, much less likely to have secret, illegitimate babies. The thing is, if looking like a baby makes you successful, why isn't Newt Gingrich president?
I was just about to say.
Here is your next limerick.
A congressional session is daunting. I find that our manners are wanting. Instead of a hearing, there's teasing and jeering. Yes, most of our time is spent.
Taunting?
Yes, taunting. Very good. Research out of Harvard has found that members of Congress waste 27% of their time taunting each other. Although I don't think that's wasting time. They should referee Congress like the NBA. If a senator gets two technicals for taunting, he's ejected, he tears his jacket, shirt, and tie off and heads to the locker room while all the other senators throw beer at him. All right, very good. Here is your last limerick.
The toilet bowl sign gets me thinking. For this courthouse, my trust is now shrinking. Yes, I am appalled by the sign in the stalls. It says, please don't use them for...
drinking.
Drinking, yes. The City Hall in Chandler, Arizona, has posted signs reminding people not to drink from the toilet.
Is the entire city council made up of German shepherds?
No. They say they put up these signs, please do not drink from the toilet, because they've recently installed one of these gray water systems that use recycled water to flush toilets to save water, and it would make somebody ill if they were to drink from the toilet. However, what is worse? Risking that somebody occasionally gets sick from that, or revealing to the world at large that toilet drinking is something you have to prevent?
What's going on in Arizona?
Not
anything. I mean, there's that saying, like, oh, there's something in the water, but apparently there's something
the
in
problem.
The toilet water.
Carl, how did Melissa do in our quiz?
Melissa, you had 3 correct answers, so you win our prize.
Well done. Congratulations.
Yay.
Thank you so much for playing, Melissa.
Great, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now it is time to move on to our final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Charlie Pierce has the lead, Peter. He has 4 points. Jesse Klein and Tom Beaudet are tied for second. They both have 3 points.
Well, we have flipped a coin. Jesse has elected to go second. Tom, you're up first. Now, all of your questions are going to be about political denials. Fill in the blank. Defending himself in the Watergate scandal, President Richard Nixon held a press conference to say, quote, I am not a blank.
Correct.
Right. In a press conference, President Clinton said that he had not had blank.
Sexual relations with that woman.
Exactly right. 18th century author Parson Weems is responsible for the apocryphal story in which George Washington says that he cannot blank.
Tell a lie.
Right. In 2009, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford explained his mysterious absence by saying he'd been blanking.
Hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Right. When he was accused of failing to pay taxes, New York Mayor David Dinkins said, quote, I haven't committed a crime. What I did was blank.
What I did was what everybody does.
What I did was fail to comply with the law. After he was busted for soliciting an undercover cop in an airport bathroom, Senator Larry Craig blamed his blank.
His wide stance.
Yes, indeed. When asked if a crotch photo on his Twitter feed was him, blank initially said he couldn't say with certitude if it was or not.
Hard to forget the name, Anthony Weiner.
Right. When asked if he had been the victim of stereotypes about Italian men, Silvio Berlusconi said, I'm not a playboy, I'm blank.
I'm a god.
He said, I'm not a playboy, I'm a playman. Berlusconi went on to praise his comfy lazy man recliner and talk about how much he loves the games on his game man. Carl, how did Tom do in our quiz?
Tom had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. He now has 15 points, and Tom has taken the lead.
Well done. All right. Jesse, you're up next. All of your questions are about celebrities and politics. Here we go. Fill in the blank. George Clooney and Sarah Jessica Parker were among those that held fundraising dinners for blank in 2012.
Barack Obama.
Right, after Marilyn Monroe sang happy birthday to him, President Blank joked that now he could retire from politics.
Kennedy.
Right. To symbolize budget cuts he'd been making, in 2009, California Governor Blank released a video of himself brandishing a huge knife.
Schwarzenegger.
Yes. In an effort to appeal to voters, in 2003, a Russian regional governor changed his name to blank.
I'm blanking on the blank.
Harry Ionovich Potter. Country music stations across the country pulled the Dixie Chicks from their playlists after the group made negative comments about blank.
Bush.
Right. In 2006, NFL star Drew Brees took legal action to stop blank from using his image in campaign ads.
Wait, in which year?
2006.
Who was Nixon? No, I'm just saying. 2006. Oh God, I just Tom wins. I don't know.
No, it was.
I mean, honestly.
Drew Brees took legal action to stop his mother from using his image in a campaign ad. Drew Brees' mother, Mina, was a Democratic candidate in Austin, Texas, so why not use photos of her famous son to promote her campaign? Drew Brees was not amused and issued a cease and desist order. Mina Brees complied and said that in retrospect, she probably should not have used his naked baby pictures.
Well, you do want to have an image of a baby out there somewhere.
That's true. Carl, how did Jesse do in our quiz?
Jesse had just 4 correct answers for 8 more points. She now has 11. Tom Baudet retains the lead with 15 points.
And how many does Charlie need to win?
7 correct answers.
Here we go, Charlie. This is for the game, and all of your questions today are going to be about first ladies.
Ooh.
Fill in the blank. After going public with her struggle with alcoholism in 1982, former first lady blank opened her famous substance abuse clinic.
Betty Ford.
Yes. As part of her Let's Move initiative, blank became the only first lady to dance the Dougie and the Running Man at an official appearance.
Michelle Obama.
Yes. After marrying French President Nicolas Sarkozy, former supermodel blank became a dual citizen of France and Italy.
Heck's her name? Carla Bruni?
Right. First Lydia Claudia Alta Taylor Johnson got her unique nickname when her childhood nanny said she was pretty as a blank.
Lady Bird.
Right. To win the heart of future First Lady Pat Ryan, Richard Nixon used to blank.
Drive her home from dates with other boys.
Exactly right. In 2008, Governor Sarah Palin said if she took the White House, her husband would be known as the first blank.
Dude!
Yes. Patti LuPone and Madonna are among the actresses who have portrayed Argentina's former first lady blank.
Eva Perón.
Right. When Nancy Reagan asked jazz legend Miles Davis what he had done to merit an invitation to a White House dinner, he responded by saying blank.
He had painted some lovely sketches of Spain.
No. Nancy Reagan asks Miles Davis, what did you do to get invited to a White House dinner? And he said, I've changed the course of music 5 or 6 times. What have you done except sleep with the president? When asked if she'd like to invite Miles Davis to future dinner parties at the White House, Nancy Reagan just said no. Carl, did Charlie do well enough to win?
He had 7 correct answers, Peter, for 14 more points. So with 18 points, Charlie Pierce is this week's champion.
Well done. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. And Focus Features, presenting the new film Hyde Park on the Hudson, starring Bill Murray as FDR and also starring Laura Linney, in theaters everywhere on Friday. The Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions' Doug Berman, Benevolent Overlord. Philip Goedeke writes our limericks. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Thanks to the crew at the Music Center at Strathmore. The Music Center is online at www.strathmore.org. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our intern is Mackenzie Van Engelenhoven. Our program is produced by Eva Walchover and Emily Ecton. With special thanks this week to Jennifer Brendel. Technical direction is from Lorna White. Our production coordinator is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillag. And the executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to Tom Baudet, Jesse Klein, and Charlie Pierce. Thanks to Blythe Haga. Thanks to the wonderful crowd at the Music Center at Strathmore in North Bethesda, Maryland. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR.
celebrating 50 years of community service and community support, this is 90.3 WPLN Nashville Public Radio, 91.5 WTML Tullahoma, and 91.7 WHRS Cookeville. You can find a complete schedule of all our programs and listen to a live stream of any of our program channels at WPLN.org. It's 12 o'clock.